For argument, Town Square Media versus Brill. Ms. Kelly.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Cindy Kelly of Kazowitz, Benton, Torres, and Friedman for the appellant, Town Square Media, formerly known as Regent Communications. Your Honors, I would like to first quickly address the issue of this Court's jurisdiction to hear this appeal. I don't think that there's any real question that this case falls squarely within the Supreme Court's holding in Carlsbad Technology.
But could I ask you something? Did you argue in either court below that jurisdiction must be assessed at the time of the removal, or did you simply argue that leave had not been granted to file the Second Amended complaint, and so the First Amended complaint was the only operative complaint?
Your Honor, we argued both. The notice of removal was before, in our notice of removal, we obviously argued supplemental jurisdiction. That was before the bankruptcy court. That was also before the district court. We focused our arguments on the First Amended complaint being the operative document, both because we thought that the court had erred procedurally and because it was that document upon which jurisdiction is based. It is black-letter law that the operative document is the document at the time of removal and that jurisdiction is not lost by subsequent filings. And so for that reason, we focused our arguments on the First Amended complaint being the operative document. Now, in Carlsbad, the Supreme Court rejected the finding of the Court of Appeals that remand order could be colorably characterized as a remand based on subject matter jurisdiction and therefore could not be reviewed on appeal. That is precisely what the appellees are trying to do here, to characterize the remand as solely one of subject matter jurisdiction when, in fact, it was not. Now, how do we know that this is not a 1447 case? Well, to begin with, nowhere did the bankruptcy court or the district court discuss or even reference.
You litigate your claims in federal court under diversity under the supplemental jurisdiction, or do you want to go back to state court, or what?
No, Your Honor, we want to be in federal court. We think that we are appropriately in federal court, both
Press state law claims.
To press
supplemental claims.
Well, Your Honor, actually, we believe that they are core claims, that they are not only supplemental claims. We think we have jurisdiction under both arguments, that they are core.
Any difference? But they'd be governed by state law, wouldn't they?
They would. Well, they'd be governed essentially in part by state law, but we believe that the rulings of the bankruptcy court, the sale order, for example, is going to be very relevant for the determination of those proceedings. So it's both determinations in the bankruptcy court as well as the interplay of state law.
Ms. Kelly, where in the courts below did you argue for supplemental jurisdiction over the claims that remained after the filing of the Second Amendment complaint? And I'm assuming, okay, that the bankruptcy court implicitly allowed the filing when it assessed jurisdiction using only that Second Amendment complaint.
Yeah, and I think the record is a little confusing because there was some gamesmanship here by the appellees, and that what happened is we went to the bankruptcy court for a hearing on several other issues. There was supposed to be simultaneous briefing on those issues. It was related to the debtors' proceedings that had been brought in state court and whether those proceedings barred the claims that were being brought by Brill. Instead of having simultaneous briefing, the appellee then sought an extension and filed their second amended complaint after we had filed our initial papers to the bankruptcy court. So we then went into the bankruptcy court having not briefed anything related to the second amended complaint and essentially being blindsided by it. During that hearing, we asked the bankruptcy court if we could have supplemental briefing so that we could address the second amended complaint and would address supplemental jurisdiction therein. But we didn't receive that briefing. So we never got to fully address those issues in papers before the court. But certainly the notice of removal was before the court. We brought that to the attention of the district court.
Okay. Thanks.
So going back to what demonstrates that this is not a remand under 1447.
The Second Amendment complaint, it's your complaint, isn't it?
We're the defendants, Your Honor.
I'm sorry? I have it backwards then.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm confused. You have to straighten me out. So Well, you're the plaintiff, aren't you?
No, Your Honor. We are the appellant. We're Town Square Media, Region Communications. The action was brought by Brill.
Your brief describes you as the plaintiff appellant. Doesn't it? Unless I'm in the wrong case.
I feel like I'm in the wrong room.
No, you represent... Well, the case is captioned Town Square Media versus Brill in our... Right, this brief is your brief?
Well, yes, we are the appellants. We're the move-ins here.
Well, the case is captioned Town Square Media, formerly known as Regent, plaintiff appellant.
Maybe that's a misnomer in that we are the move-ins, and maybe it was mislabeled as plaintiff. We are the defendants in the underlying action.
You're the defendants, and you want to be defending in federal court, is that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your contention is that the second amended complaint, which was a surprise to you, contains supplemental claims?
It does, Your Honor. I'll just to give you a little procedural history since there's some confusion. The action was brought by Brill against our clients, against Town Square Media, and a number of other defendants.
Regent, yes. So Brill is accusing you of having used information in your confidentiality agreement to outbid them for these bankrupt properties. Okay, I get that much. And your contention, if I understand correctly, is that these claims by Brill include supplemental claims governed by state law, and you want the district court to decide whether to hold on to them or relinquish jurisdiction to the state courts. Is that what you want?
Well, it's not only supplemental jurisdiction. We also believe that the remaining claims are core bankruptcy claims, which give rise to original jurisdiction. So we are arguing in the alternative for both original jurisdiction and
supplemental jurisdiction. But the supplemental claims are critical, aren't they? Because if the supplemental claims weren't in the picture, wouldn't there be a strong inference that the judge had dismissed the case because he thought he didn't have subject matter jurisdiction, which would be unreviewable, however goofy his decision?
Absolutely, and that's why
you've got to find supplemental claims in this second amended complaint.
Well, no, in the first amended complaint, because that was the operative document at the time of removal. So if there was supplemental jurisdiction arising from the first amended complaint, that jurisdiction remains, and that gives rise to this court's jurisdiction. So it's not critical that we find supplemental jurisdiction in the second amended complaint, only the first.
Yeah.
And I don't even think that appellees actually dispute that there was, because if you look at the first amended complaint, there's no question that it included claims that were property of the debtors in the bankruptcy proceeding. In the first amended complaint, there were 20 defendants and 34 causes of action, including claims that were duplicative of claims that were brought by the debtors in separate state court proceedings. So there was no issue as to original jurisdiction over that first amended complaint, and appellees have conceded as much.
Yeah,
and
but Brill wants us to use the second amended complaint, because if that's the operative complaint, then the case belongs in state court.
That may very well be the case.
Isn't that the nutshell?
That is the nutshell. But,
okay.
Your Honor, it's black letter law that's just not what
No, you don't have to fight with
okay.
me.
No, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that is what it boils down to, that we need to look at the First Amendment complaint that gives rise to this court's jurisdiction, because there's no question that there was jurisdiction over that First Amendment complaint, including supplemental jurisdiction, gives rise to this court's jurisdiction to do two things, though, to review the decision on supplemental jurisdiction, but to
What if Brill files a First Amendment complaint that's full of these state law claims, supplemental claims? Well, that's fine. And then after a while, Brill decides, I'm not interested in supplemental complaints. So he files a new complaint, second amended complaint, no supplemental claims. And the district court says, well, I don't think I have jurisdiction, and dismisses it. Be odd. Why would the abandoned supplemental complaints have conferred jurisdiction on us to refer to review the district judge's decision they didn't have subject matter jurisdiction?
I'm not sure in that scenario.
Jurisdiction, can't
I'm
you?
Not sure in that scenario if it would. I think that the remand has to be. There has to be a decision made to remand based on a discretionary remand under 1367C to give rise to this court's jurisdiction. I'm not sure I followed your scenario completely procedurally
but
as to timing.
What if the supplemental claims have disappeared from the case? They've been abandoned before the judge rules on a motion to dismiss. All he has before him, we'll say, is some bankruptcy-like claim which he decides is not within his jurisdiction. But there's no state law claim. He throws it out.
And he throws it out. So what is remaining is he remands the case then?
Oh, so let me give you a fantastic example. Okay, suppose the original complaint charges securities fraud, and it says that the securities in question are grapefruits, and there are also a bunch of supplemental state law claims. And in the second amended complaint, the plaintiff drops all the supplemental state law claims, so all he has is a securities law claim based on the proposition that grapefruits are securities within the meaning of the 1933 Act. And suppose the court says, look, grapefruits are not securities. And that's so obvious that this securities claim is not even within federal jurisdiction. And so I don't have subject matter jurisdiction. I'm dismissing. Now, and to be perfectly correct, your proposition is that because there were supplemental claims earlier, we can review his dismissal for want of subject matter jurisdiction, even though the only thing left in the case at that stage is this obviously jurisdictionless securities.
No, you would not have jurisdiction in that case because in that case.
How is this different?
Well, in that case, he's making the remand solely under 1447 C or D, finding that there's no subject matter jurisdiction. So unless there's another exception, which the courts have been inclined to find quite a few exceptions, but unless there's another one that I don't know about, that you would not have jurisdiction in that case. It's the opposite that happened here. The court dismissed the federal claims, but still had the state claims and could have exercised supplemental jurisdiction over those claims. So
you're saying the second amended complaint contains supplemental claims?
The remaining supplemental claims. They were supplemental to the prior federal claims.
Misunderstood.
So it's the exact opposite of the scenario that you just posed. So in that case, obviously, you know, the court would not have jurisdiction, but in this case it does. So the court can look at both whether the bankruptcy court had original jurisdiction. And, Your Honor, I would just briefly like to say that in this case, I think it clearly does. And In Re Repository and Baker versus Kingsley both advocate the dual review that I'm talking about here and which appellees have objected to, meaning you look at original jurisdiction because once you have the hook of jurisdiction, you may look at everything. You're not confined solely to supplemental jurisdiction. So I would ask that this court look closely at the core jurisdiction because that is where I think that the bankruptcy court erred in arguing that this was not a case that arises in a bankruptcy proceeding because that's exactly what the appellees are challenging, our actions in the bankruptcy proceeding. If there had been no auction, if there had been no sale order, we would have no case today. That is the precise definition of arising in a bankruptcy proceeding.
Yes, but their argument is that it's true there wouldn't have been a sale and auction, all that, and so on. Okay, but they're saying you're not, or they're saying they're not, Brill is not challenging anything in the sale or auction itself. It's just challenging the fact that you were able to do better in the sale because you had stolen information from them, in effect, and that's just a state law a violation.
Right. They're trying to separate it, but you can't separate it when the action that they're challenging is the very action that took place in the proceeding. It's very similar to In Re Repository, where what they were challenging, even though they were bringing state law claims in In Re Repository, the action that they were challenging.
The judge, when he's considering a sale, he can't go back and unravel all the rights and wrongs that may have influenced the sale, the price that one of the bidders bid? I mean, that would be crazy.
Absolutely.
It?
That's precisely right. That's why this case should be barred by collateral estoppel and res judicata, because there was already a finding in the bankruptcy court that we acted in good faith, that there was no collusion, there was no fraud, that we gave proper consideration. And you're right. It's totally inappropriate and impossible for the bankruptcy court to go back and unravel. Yeah. And that's why it should be barred by collateral estoppel and res judicata.
Let me keep you just a couple of minutes. You were the plaintiff in the district court, right?
Yes, and maybe that's where the misunderstanding came about, because we were, yes. I'm sorry for that confusion.
The misunderstanding came about because of what it says on the blue brief.
I know.
Well, the order of the district court indicates you as plaintiff.
You were the plaintiff in the sense of...
In the sense that we were appealing the bankruptcy court's ruling.
Right. But yes. But they're the original.
Exactly.
They're the real plaintiff.
Right. They are the true plaintiff.
You're an appellant.
Correct.
It's amazing having people fighting over who will be the plaintiff.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Kelly.
Thank you.
Mr. Fowler? Thanks for clarifying.
Could I just ask you a question real quickly so
yes.
My head will be clear to this case? Woo. If the courts below should have assessed jurisdiction using the first amended complaint, you do concede, do you not, that there is federal subject matter jurisdiction? Because, of course, the general rule is that we assess jurisdiction at the time of removal.
I think looking at the complaint that was originally filed by my client, then pro se, I will add, if you look at that, we've never contested.
Wait a minute. Stop for a minute. Now you're the plaintiff?
In state court.
In state court.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
My client filed a pro se complaint. My client filed a pro se complaint in state court. It was removed.
Yeah.
We've never contested, nor was it our charge to contest whether or not removal was appropriate. The bankruptcy court invited my client, because the bankruptcy court was being kind, to obtain counsel to focus on the real claims at issue. We did. We amended the complaint. And actually, he had amended it once earlier. We actually amended the second time when we got in the case, essentially with the bankruptcy court's blessing and upon proper motion. There was a hearing, and I'm disappointed that we've been accused of gamesmanship by counsel who wasn't even involved at that stage or at the district court stage, and doesn't know what happened, apparently. But there was a hearing after we filed our amended complaint, weeks later, at which time we talked about jurisdiction in the context of the second amended complaint.
Yeah, and whether because or not you didn't address the first amended
complaint
in your brief. So you also didn't address whether the courts below abuse their discretion in declining to exercise supplemental jurisdiction.
And that's why this case. Well, that's why this appeal is barred.
Yeah, but would you address that abuse of discretion argument now?
I will.
Okay.
And I will if I could just because there's been confusion here, and I hope it's not intentional about what happened, and I've been accused of gamesmanship, which is fine so long as it's the good kind.
Don't have your feelings hurt.
But
this is, you know.
But nevertheless, they had full opportunity to address jurisdiction as related to the claims in the second amended complaint, which is the operative complaint. We properly moved for leave to file at the court.
Wait a minute. If the bankruptcy court below lacked subject matter jurisdiction over the case, how could it allow the second amended complaint? I mean, it just doesn't... It doesn't make sense that the court could allow the second amendment and then use the second amended complaint to find it lacked subject matter jurisdiction. It makes far more sense to assess jurisdiction using the state of affairs at the time of removal.
Now, as the district court held, once it held that it did not have jurisdiction over the complaint as amended, it had jurisdiction to do nothing else. So its ruling on collateral estoppel, res judicata issues, which they want to raise today, the district court correctly concluded that the bankruptcy court shouldn't have reached those issues once it determined it didn't have jurisdiction over the claims in the
state. But are there supplemental claims in the case?
There aren't any claims other than the state law claims that exist in the second amended complaint. There's four. Regent never asked the bankruptcy court to hold supplemental jurisdiction over the claims in that complaint. Look at the district court. I mean, here's their brief. Here's the proposed fines.
Brill,
here's the order. It's
Brill,
not in there. It's
Brill,
never an issue was raised.
Did Brill have a federal claim?
Does Brill have a federal claim?
Yes.
No, sir.
So you're saying the First Amendment complaint does not the First Amendment complaint doesn't contain a federal claim?
Well, it's actually the second one, the Second Amendment complaint that
I'm
we're talking
about. About the First Amendment complaint. There is a First Amendment complaint, isn't there?
There was.
That's your complaint, right? Whose complaint is that?
Well, I don't want to get hung up on your, but Mr. Brill filed a complaint. He amended a complaint pro se.
Is that the First Amendment complaint?
The one he amended pro se, yes. But the one we filed, the Second Amendment complaint.
Aren't you Brill?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the we and the he and the... I don't understand.
I'm just trying to explain.
What difference does it make whether he was represented or not represented?
The First Amendment complaint, the one prior to the current version of the complaint, contain claims that arguably were within the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court.
Okay, so the First Amendment complaint has a federal claim, and dangling from it are some state claims, which would be supplemental. Is that correct? Is that a correct characterization of the First Amendment complaint?
There was no finding that there was supplemental jurisdiction. They were never asked to.
Talking about findings, would you please answer my question without fencing? I asked you, does the First Amendment complaint contain a federal claim, and dangling from it, or you can leave out the dangling, you don't need that, state law claims?
Under 1360, I think the answer is no. And the reason is, under 1367, there has to be some sort of an entanglement. For the court to exercise supplemental jurisdiction...
Don't complicate things. There's a federal claim and there are state claims in the First Amendment complaint, right?
Federal in the sense that they were subject to the bankruptcy court jurisdiction. They weren't based on federal law or anything like that. And there was not...
What? Okay, that's a different subtle argument. But there's a federal claim and there are state claims. Okay. Now, the Second Amendment complaint, what happened there? How does that differ from the first?
Well, for one, there went from 33 counts to four. There went from
Not an interesting difference. What is the
difference? There
are no
claims. There are state law claims for fraud, promissory estoppel, unjust enrichment, and breach of contract. Those are the four claims. They are all state law claims. None of them in any way touch upon
the bankruptcy court. You're saying that between the First and Second Amended complaint, Brill abandoned his federal claim.
Correct.
And then the district court dismissed the Second Amended complaint because these were no longer supplemental claims, because there was nothing for them to supplement?
Actually, the court didn't raise the issue, and neither did they, the party, about whether or not they were no longer supplemental. The court analyzed the issue as, are the claims in the Second Amended complaint, does the bankruptcy court have subject matter jurisdiction over them? That was the issue.
Well, that depends on their status as supplemental claims.
Well, not according to Regent. The Regent wants to argue that...
Not according to what?
The Regent. They want to argue in Town Square, formerly Regent. They argue
What's your position?
No. The bankruptcy court has no jurisdiction over the claims remaining in the second.
Because they're not supplemental to anything?
They're not supplemental in the sense that they are not tied to, or there are no other claims. There's nothing to supplement to. And even if you were to resurrect claims that existed at one point.
Okay, you have an argument that even in the First Amendment complaint, they weren't supplemental because the federal claim to which they were supplemental was only federal because it had arisen in bankruptcy and it really didn't involve, federal statutory or constitutional provision. I understand that argument. And now your second argument is that even if those were supplemental claims, the first amended complaint, in the second amended complaint, because the federal claim, the bankruptcy claim, had disappeared, there were just these four state law claims, there was nothing they could be supplemental to, and therefore there was no possible federal jurisdiction. Is that your argument?
That's correct, Judge.
And in the order, the district court said they affirmed the indication of lack of jurisdiction and vacates the what amounted to the state law claims. Right.
That's right. And it's, I think it's a point that bears repeating. If I didn't make it earlier, I apologize. And the reason I talked about the get hung up on the supplemental, under 1447 C and D, this court can't even hear an appeal unless it is of an order.
Yeah, we know that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, but that's the point. District court did not determine that supplemental jurisdiction existed or did not exist. The bankruptcy court did not. They were not asked to.
He just said we don't have jurisdiction, that was it.
Well, and if you look at the analysis, they're talking about subject matter jurisdiction. And that order, which is the order that was appealed to the district court, which is the order that is being appealed here today, that order is not subject, is not appealable under 1447. Now, could they have asked the court to invoke supplemental jurisdiction over these claims and saying, even though they're state law claims, they were really attached to these other claims which no longer exist, but you should continue to retain jurisdiction over them? They could have made that argument, but they didn't. We would have addressed it, but they didn't. Look at their brief. They don't even cite the 1367. I have their briefs at the district court level. It's not even cited. The statute's not even cited. The argument wasn't made. They had the opportunity to make it, and they didn't. So in the first instance, Judge, I believe that we aren't really properly here today in that sense. And then when you look at subject matter jurisdiction as it applies to the claims, do they arise under or are they related to? We brief that. These claims are based upon private conduct. Theft of confidential information, which occurred prior to this auction.
Did the district court affirm the bankruptcy judge because the district court thought it didn't have jurisdiction, or because it thought the bankruptcy judge's ruling was correct?
Honestly, Judge, I'm not sure that I appreciate the distinction of your question.
I'm sorry, I did not hear your answer.
I'm not sure I appreciate the distinction.
Well, the 1448 or whatever we're talking about, it applies when the district court dismisses for want of subject matter jurisdiction. So when the district court, but the district court's order affirms the bankruptcy court and says the bankruptcy court had no jurisdiction.
Correct.
Once you were down to the state law claims.
Correct.
But the district court didn't say that it lacked jurisdiction. It affirmed because it thought the bankruptcy court had made a correct jurisdictional ruling. But it certainly had jurisdiction to affirm the bankruptcy court.
Yes, Judge. 1447 only applies to appeals of district court orders. So 1447 would not bar the district court having the power to review that and to determine whether or not the bankruptcy court has jurisdiction. It's just, it applies to this court's review of the district court's order, if that makes sense.
No. Did the district court say it didn't have jurisdiction?
District court had jurisdiction to rule on the bankruptcy court's order of remand. It did, absolutely.
But there is a difference between affirming another agency's jurisdictional ruling and saying, I don't have jurisdiction over this case.
Mm-hmm. Well, it did review the same facts, the same complaint, independently determined that the bankruptcy court was correct, and there was no deference attached to it.
But you can't determine that another court was correct if you don't have jurisdiction, right?
That's an advisory opinion of some sort, and we're not in that business.
I think the district court had jurisdiction to determine whether or not the bankruptcy court was correct.
Well, could have dismissed only if, for lack or no jurisdiction.
Yes.
Rather than affirm.
Yes.
But it didn't,
yeah.
Well, affirming the order dismissed the adversary claim and remanded it. And that's what the bankruptcy court did.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Fowler. Ms. Kelly, further?
Just very briefly, Mr. Fowler said that it's not clear what the bankruptcy court was doing, if they were making a decision on supplemental jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction. And I just wanted to point this court to the decision in Baker v. Kingsley, where the court said that where alternative readings of the lower court's decision are possible, where it's unclear what exactly they are doing, then review is appropriate. And one of the things that the court in Baker found determinative was that after the court there decided to remand, it went on to decide another issue related to service on one of the defendants, indicating that it really was going on, that it really did view itself as having jurisdiction. And that's what the bankruptcy court did here. It decided to remand, but then it went on to talk about issues of collateral estoppel and res judicata, which clearly indicate that the court did think that it had supplemental jurisdiction.
The court doesn't have supplemental jurisdiction, does it? Or does it?
It does, Your Honor. It does. The courts are split. The bankruptcy courts are split on when and whether they should exercise supplemental jurisdiction, but
so
it does.
Are you saying that what the district court did here was to affirm the voluntary relinquishment by the bankruptcy court of its supplemental claims?
That's correct.
I'm reading from the last paragraph. Well, next to the last paragraph. This is the district court saying, once the bankruptcy court determined that the Second Amendment complaint was in play and that based on the claims now alleged by Brill and the non-debtors, it had no jurisdiction, no further resolution of issues was necessary, and no action other than the remand of Brill's lawsuit could be taken. Remand to the state court.
That's correct. The district court, yes, was criticizing the bankruptcy court for going on and deciding those issues, and I think that the district court missed the nuance, which is what we're raising here, is that what the bankruptcy court actually was doing was making a decision on supplemental jurisdiction. And that is why it thought it could go on to decide those issues, because it determined not to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the case, but it was exercising supplemental jurisdiction to decide certain issues. And that's what we've tried to argue to the to the district court, that is why we had to focus on the First Amendment complaint, and that's what really was going on here was an exercise of supplemental jurisdiction. Nothing further.
In the ordinary supplemental jurisdiction case, the district court will decide the federal claim on the merits, deny it or vindicated or whatever, and then it'll have to make a judgment whether to go on and decide the supplemental claims or relinquish them to the state court. But if the federal claim is dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, was it? No, I don't know.
It was not dismissed for lack.
It was
withdrawn.
It was
right. The complaint was amended.
So you're saying, okay, so your argument, I think, is that, let me see if this is right. Brill files a First Amendment complaint, and it's got a main federal claim. Now, Mr. Fowler argues that that's not a real federal claim. That's a subtlety, so set that aside. So assume it's a real federal claim. It's got a whole bunch of supplemental claims. So so the bankruptcy court has jurisdiction over the supplemental claims. Then a new complaint is filed. The federal claim is withdrawn, but there's still the... they're fewer, but there's still a bunch of state law claims. They're supplemental in the sense that this was a case that had a federal claim. It got abandoned, but jurisdiction attached when the federal claim was filed. That created jurisdiction over the supplemental claims. And then the bankruptcy judge, you say, is best interpreted as saying, well, I'm not going to deal with the supplemental claims because there's no more nothing interesting to me as a bankruptcy judge left. So it relinquishes jurisdiction, and you say that's what the district court affirmed. So you say the dismissal by the affirmance, whatever the district court did, It was just confirming a discretionary judgment not to litigate the supplemental claims, and that falls within Carlsbad. Is that your argument?
That is almost all precisely right, with just one amendment to it. Those remaining state law claims, supplemental claims, we argue that they're not just supplemental, but they actually give rise to original jurisdiction as well, because they are core bankruptcy claims.
Right.
The bankruptcy court disagrees with us, but we make both arguments, that they are both original and supplemental. In the lower courts, we did focus on the original arguments rather than supplemental, but both arguments were raised.
Okay, well, thank you. I hope we'll struggle some more.
We will
try to understand what's going on.
Thank you.
And we'll blame the Supreme Court.
Yeah.